But let's now get to today's topic, which is really going to be expanded a bit because of events of the last, you know, week and a half or 2 weeks. Before we get to today's topic, I will ask my fellow panelists, I'll do Farvez's introduction. So if Betsy, you just briefly introduce yourself. And
hi, thanks for being here. My name is Pastor Betsy Willett-Zierden, and I'm the pastor at Good Samaritan United Methodist Church.
Father Tim Holita, co-cathedral of St. Thomas More.
And I'm Josh Hall with First Baptist Church.
So sitting to my right is Dr. Farvez Ahmed. And I'm going to be just blunt and honest. I asked Farvez to do this because Farvez and I are our families are very close friends, and Farvez is a very dear friend of mine. And the reason why I wanted him to do this conversation is because we have been working on these kinds of issues now for close to 10 years. And we have the kind of relationship that we know what has to be brought out into the open and discussed. Because of that, I want to just kind of outline a couple things. Liberals right now are really ticked off. Really ticked off. But we have to have a conversation today which will push aside some of the barriers of political correctness in order to ask the questions that need to be asked to really expose the fears and concerns of all people. And so whether you are liberal or conservative, your questions will be wanted, and you cannot be afraid to ask whatever is on your mind. Because Farvez will not, I don't want to speak for you, you can affirm this in a minute, will not be insulted or upset. Instead, both of us agree, we have to have a blunt, honest conversation, not a superficial conversation. With that in mind, I ask my friend to introduce himself.
Well, Jack, you forgot to also say that we're also writing a book.
I didn't want to say that until we got a little further.
Well, the burden is on me because you have already completed the first chapter, and I'm in the middle of that. I'm Farvez Ahmed. I'm professor of finance at the Coggin College of Business at the University of North Florida in Jacksonville. I'm also the director of the graduate programs for the Coggin College of Business. But my association with Jack has been in the field of interfaith dialogue, intercultural understanding, civic discourse, and we have been working on these issues for the last 10 years, as Jack mentioned. And I've visited Tallahassee many times, spoken at Village Square and in other venues in Tallahassee. And I'm glad to be back, and I'm glad to be back at Temple Israel.
So I'm going to leap right in. I'm going to start with asking a few questions. I'm going to ask the thoughts or reactions of my fellow clergy panelists as we get to different parts. But you guys understand I'm going to be focused on Farvez for the first few minutes. So Farvez, I'm going to start with the blunt, open question, and then I'm going to push you. Is Islam compatible with Western democracy?
It's a great question, but I'm sometimes bothered by the framing of that question. Because America was founded on the ideal of religious liberty. It's in our founding ideals, in the foundational statements issued by George Washington, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson owned a copy of the Quran, which is actually available in the Library of the Congress. When the first Muslim American was elected to the House of Representatives, he took his oath on Thomas Jefferson's Quran. So the foundation of America acknowledged that Islam is going to be part of this society. And Muslims are not new immigrants in this country. Muslims arrived in this country at least with the first slave ships. Conservative estimates of Muslim migration to the United States with the first slave ships was about 20 to 25%. The Islam that they brought obviously did not survive the ravages of slavery. But there are remnants of that civilization, that culture, present until this day. One point of information, and you may disagree with this, you may want to do more research on it, that the roots of the quintessentially American music, the blues, has its roots in the Islamic call to prayer. And there is a wonderful academic discourse written by a curator at New York, and she has documented how the call to prayer animated the roots of blues music. So Islam is part of America. Whether it is compatible or not will entirely depend upon how people who practice Islam choose to practice their faith. And so far the evidence, again, I know we live in an era where data does not matter, facts do not matter, but I do think they should matter. So I'll blurt out some facts and then you can deal with them and push me back or ask questions on that whichever way you wish. The last comprehensive survey of the American Muslim community was done by Pew Research. As you know who Pew Research is, it's one of the largest foundations out there that does research on faith and public life. And it polls various faith communities. One of the largest survey of the American Muslim community was done by Pew, if I recall correctly, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. It's a long survey, as you can imagine all surveys are. Many questions, many details. Here was their top line conclusion, that the American Muslim community is as American as any other faith community. In every aspect, education, wealth, integration, they are no different than any other faith community. Educationally, they come only second to the Jewish community. Wealth-wise, they come only second to the Jewish community, perhaps the Hindu community. So, by any metric that you want to measure, the community is well integrated into American life. And generally, even, and this was before this election cycle, so this, again, the research is 2 or 3 years back, they generally express more positivity about American society despite the presence of large-scale discrimination against the community than the general public expresses. So the community is well-integrated, optimistic, and they view themselves as American. It is an important part of the Muslim community's identity.
But the question really is that that I think probably sits somewhere in the thoughts of everybody in the room. Islam as a religion, can you practice Islam and still feel comfortable in America? I'm really not talking about those that have come and been integrated in part of American society, because, you know, I would say, let me put it a different way. I would say that Judaism is an Eastern religion that has been corrupted by American values. Okay, so now let's talk about Islam. Is the Islam that's practiced here kind of integrated into America, or does it reflect a true representation of the core of Islamic ideals?
Islam is not a monolithic religion. 1.6 billion people cannot believe in the same thing. There's going to be a wide variation. If you travel anywhere in the Muslim countries, anywhere where Muslims live as large minorities, I come from India, the largest Muslim population, the largest minority Muslim population in the world. Over 250 million Muslims are Indians. So there are more Muslims in India than in the Middle East. Let's put it that way. And the Islam that is practiced by Muslims of India is going to look very different than the Islam being practiced by Muslims living in Saudi Arabia. Islam being practiced by the Muslims in Indonesia will look different than the Islam being practiced by the Muslims in, let's say, sub-Saharan Africa. So the question is, does the Islam that is practiced by Muslims in this country look different? Is it adapted? I would not use the word corrupted, because Islam would not have spread as fast as it has spread across the world without having this form of adaptability into the local culture. Wherever Islam went, it adapted and adopted the local culture. Sometimes it influenced the local culture, and many times the local culture influenced it back. And you see this most vividly, perhaps if you study the cultures of India. Almost everything about Indian cultural expression today is touched by Islamic expression. And everything about Islam in India is touched by the culture of the dominant people, the dominant religions and people in India. Same thing holds here. For example, I'll give you some simple, tangible examples. The way mosques and Islamic centers are organized in America is not organized anywhere else in the Muslim world. So if you go to a mosque in, let's say, Saudi Arabia or Egypt, they are generally foundations or donations by wealthy people, and the people who govern the mosque are usually government appointed, including the imam whose salary comes from the government. In America, the Islamic centers resemble the structure of your temple. It has a community board. The board is a nonprofit organization, has a board of trustees. The board of trustees elect a group of people. The membership elects the board of trustees, and then the board of trustees hires the imam or the rabbi, whichever. Pretty much looks like any other house of worship. That's an innovation. To me, it's not a corruption. To me, it's an adaptability into the local culture. That's the only way houses of worship can be governed in this culture, and that's the way Muslims adopted into this culture.
So what you're saying, though, causes a kind of a cognitive dissonance, because it's very easy for me, as an example, to look at my friend sitting next to me, talk of all the things that we've shared with our families together and so forth, and say, yes, okay, my Muslim neighbor is my friend and my neighbor, but you know, how can I possibly feel that way about the person in Saudi Arabia in a culture that breeds terrorists, in a culture that breeds those people? I mean, you know, we'll talk about the refugee thing in a while, but it's Saudi Arabia that breeds so many of those that have attacked the United States. So how do I deal with that cognitive dissonance? How do I somehow make, you know, reconcile my feeling for you as my friend versus my fear of those from Saudi Arabia and and Iran, and you know, I can name a group of countries.
So the way to address this is to avoid looking at people through singular identities. A Muslim in America is not only a Muslim, he's also an American, or she's also an American. So if you, and they have other identities. For example, my identity is not only shaped by my faith, it is shaped by my citizenship, my nationality, the culture to which I was born, the language which I speak, the institution that which I work for, the people that I associate with. If we only view, and this is the reduction, this is the problem today with viewing Muslims in America. It's an extremely reductionist viewpoint that the singular lens with which we want to evaluate Muslims is through their faith, not the faith that they live in this country, but the faith that they share with people who live thousands of miles away. I have more in common with Jack than a Muslim living in Saudi Arabia. I have more in common, my daughter was sitting in the audience, she has more in common with Betsy and Father Moore and I forgot your name, sorry. Stephen, right?
No.
Tim Moore.
Tim
and
St. Thomas.
Okay, I'll take Tom. I'm sorry about
call
that.
Call me whatever you want.
Sorry about that. So I have more in common. Yeah. I have more in common
well,
with
you know, all Catholics are kind of alike,
yeah,
so
exactly.
You know.
They all look the same anyway. That makes my point, right? That we have this propensity to view people who are other than us through singular identities, from which then we project everything about their worldview. And that's the danger that we have to avoid. So there are people in Saudi Arabia who are obviously doing bad things. The 15 out of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 came from Saudi Arabia. But that is not representative of either the entire Saudi Arabian society, nor can it be representative of 1.6 billion people living across the world. So we have to kind of resist that urge to reduce people's identity into singular issues, which are often issues that divide us, instead of looking at those identity perspectives that actually unite us as people.
At this point, I want to bring in the other panelists. They've come for a purpose. So I want you to either feel free to direct a question that's out of your own heart to Parvez or make a comment on what we've covered so far. Tim, you want to go first?
I'd like to ask a question. because I completely understand what you're saying, and I really, but this is the question that I have, and I do want to say that I regret that the constraints of time, and this is a complex and this is a big issue, and like you said, there's 1.6 billion, so to narrow them down and to look at them in a reduced way, or only as ISIS fighters, to limit it to that, or moderates or reform, whatever, I think that's not doing it justice. This is a complex issue. But what I am curious about is I had lunch several weeks ago with a priest, a Coptic priest. So he's not Catholic, Coptic priest from Egypt. And he shared with me his experience of being a priest trying to live in Egypt as a Christian. It's wonderful that we, you know, the minority always preaches tolerance until it's the majority. And when we look at countries that are majority Muslim, which countries in that part of the world could I go as a Christian and not be imprisoned? I mean, where could I go and start a church, a parish, preach, evangelize? Where are those Western democratic ideals found in the Muslim world? And if not, I find that interesting. Like, why is that just a cultural thing? For example, when I saw that Iran was very offended by this travel issue that's going on in our country, and they said they were very offended by that, and it was an offense to Muslims, I wondered, would I be allowed to go to their country and evangelize and start a church? I don't think so.
First of all, there are churches across most of the Muslim world. Iran, I'm not, you know, Iran may be an exception. Saudi Arabia is definitely an exception that does not allow other religious. Saudi Arabia, forget about allowing you to go and preach your religion. It will not allow Shias to go and preach in Saudi Arabia. So even with Muslims, that is going, and even within the Sunni tradition, it's only their way of looking at the Sunni tradition that they will allow. But again, the problem is, why is Saudi Arabia representative of 1.6 billion Muslims? The largest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia. The second largest Muslim population in the world is India. Both countries are secular democracies. Muslims have, Indonesia as a majority, they practice secular democracy. And as in India, as a minority, even during the time of the partition, even though the partition was largely based on religious identities, the Muslims who were left in India embraced, full-throated embracing of a secular ideal. The question of where is Western democracy practiced, well, unfortunately, Western democracy is not being practiced in our own country right now. So Western liberalism has broken down in our own country. The liberal order is not being practiced in Europe. Just go and check Hungary. So there are many examples that you can give where the ideas of liberalism is not being practiced. So why single out Saudi Arabia?
But Indonesia, I looked this up, does have a very high rating from organizations that rate whether a country is democratic or not. India is not majority Muslim.
No, but it's the largest population of Muslims.
But Indonesia was the only one that was considered a democracy. So
Indonesia is a democracy. Malaysia is a democracy. In fact, if you look at the majority Muslim population around the world, they live under democracies. Majority of Muslims around the world live under democracies.
So now I'm going to ask.
Just one point of clarification, Jack. What we tend to view as Muslims are the countries in the Middle East with which we have a conflict. And we view that conflict, unfortunately, sometimes the people and the regimes in this country want to portray the conflict in religious terms. And certainly ISIS wants to portray the conflict with the West in religious terms. And unfortunately, many times we play into the narrative that we view that our problems with Iran or whichever country that we are having a problem with is because they are Muslim, as opposed to that it's a country with a national identity, with a history, with our entangled history in the region. So when we think about Iranians having a problem with Americans, we also have to look into our own history, how we have deliberately destabilized Iran, and actually our interference in Iran led to the rise of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. We are now bothered about the religious extremism in Afghanistan, but we were happy to foment that religious extremism when we wanted those religious extremists to fight the Soviet Union. So without acknowledging our entangled history in that region, and again having, well, they hate us, and it must be because of the religion, is again the terribly reductionist viewpoint. And it has led to this, we are either A clash of civilization is underway. If not, we're on the brink of a clash of civilization. And one of the reasons we are here is because of these reductionist viewpoints.
So now I'm going to ask a really politically incorrect question.
Please do.
And put you in a tough spot.
Please.
And that is, how much of the differences, or how much do we conflate Islam and point to problems that we say as Americans are with Islam, and how much of these are due to the culture of a particular country, for example, an Arab country that has a different perspective than in India or a different perspective than in Indonesia. So, for example, how much are we conflating Arab culture with Islamic culture and saying, and pointing to something and saying, oh, this is Islam, when it's not?
Right.
That's politically incorrect, I know.
So if you look at, again, if you look at across the Muslim world, across the, 47 Muslim majority countries in the world, you will see a breathtaking diversity of social integration, democracy, rule of law, liberalism, secularism, progressivism, conservatism, fundamentalism. It spans the spans the entire spectrum. So there are places where, for example, there are regions within those 47 Muslim majority countries where empowerment of women in those countries is at horrible levels. And yet, when you compare empowerment of women in India, where I come from, which is not majority Muslim, majority 80% Hindus, to Bangladesh, which is a neighboring country, a very small country, relatively speaking, which is almost 95% Muslim, on the issue of women empowerment, Bangladesh ranks above India, something that you probably would not have ever considered. So when we look at that success, we don't say, well, Bangladesh achieved that success because of their religion. But when we look at Saudi Arabia and we see a woman being not allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia, we conclude that must be because of religion. Why? It is because of their own history, their own culture, their own politics that shaped them. As I mentioned, part of the situation in Afghanistan and even in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, what we call the AFPAC region, it is shaped by a long history of conflict. From the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan to the U.S. intervention in arming the Mujahideen to fight the Soviets, and then the post Cold War era where we essentially abandoned Afghanistan, all of that shaped what came out of that region. Religion is not a trivial part of that equation. I do acknowledge religion does play a role, but even those religious views are shaped by the very particularities of their politics, by their social structures, by their neighbors, by their global politics. For example, Iran and Saudi Arabia. I heard this from even top-ranking U.S. officials. They will often characterize the conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia as a Shia-Sunni conflict. Well, if it is a Shia-Sunni conflict, why are Shias and Sunnis not fighting in America? They're praying side by side in America. I come from India, where Shias and Sunnis have a long history of cultural cooperation, integrated marriages, integrated families, and the whole gamut. They're not killing each other in India. One of the largest Shia populations in the world is actually in India, outside of Iran and Iraq. So the conflict in between Saudi Arabia and Iran is about regional powers vying for hegemony in the region. Iran has a long history, long civilizational history. They feel that they should have a significant say in what happens in that region. Saudi Arabia views themselves as, quote-unquote, the custodians of Islam, particularly Sunni Islam. So they feel that they should have, and with the backing of the largest superpower in the world, they feel what they should be the big kid on the block. And that has created some of the tensions and the conflict. It is not purely a religious conflict, although religion does play a role in it, as it plays in every other society.
So, Betsy, I think you wanted to weigh in with something. And then Tim had a question. Then I have a question I want to direct to all three of the panelists. And then we'll do an open up to the floor. Boy, we have so much to cover and so little time to do it.
This is probably also politically incorrect. I don't know what you want to call it. But so I probably 2 years ago, there was a article in the Smithsonian, and it was a satellite picture of the Earth and the places that were dark, in other words, didn't have electricity, didn't have lights on, were also the places where there was very little education, objectification and suppression of female voices. And so when I sometimes look at this picture, maybe naively or maybe I'm brilliant, it just seems that part of it has to do with economics and education and lack of opportunity. It's when I teach Old Testament, sometimes I say, remember, this is a tribal culture. So the way we're reading it, we need to lay over a tribal lens. So based on your information, because you've studied this a lot more than most of us in the room, how does that line up with some of the things that you've been sharing? You said, you know, political differences between countries, but what about just sheer not having opportunity?
Yeah, that's always part of it. You know, every society's educational empowerment is shaped by their politics and vice versa. So education shapes politics and politics shapes education. It goes hand in hand. As another point of fact over here, I wanted to mention this as a story about, you know, how we have to avoid these reductionist viewpoints and look for things that are actually present in front of your eyes, but you're probably not recognizing it. This morning there was a news, and I've used this story many times in my previous talks and other places, but this morning, coincidentally, NPR was reporting on this story. The story is about the mayor of Jakarta in Indonesia. Indonesia, the largest Muslim country, Jakarta is the largest municipality, so the mayor of Jakarta is probably the second most powerful person in the country other than the president of the country. The mayor of Jakarta is a Christian. And he won last election with landslide victories, and he's up for re-election, he's expected to win. Of course, there's a pushback from the fundamentalist quarters, and they are using religion to push back on him and the usual conversations. So in our secular democracy, the fact that religion is being used as bright dividing lines is not unique. Other countries are doing practicing the same thing. But here is the good news from that country. The country wants to re-elect this Christian person who is the mayor of the largest city in the largest Muslim country in the world. How many of you knew that story? Probably heard this on NPR this morning, right?
Yeah. So actually, before I got to slip something in that I was going to ask about 15 minutes ago, but the conversation kind of slipped along. And that is, a lot of Americans say and believe or express that the proof that we cannot really get along with Islam as a religion is because Sharia itself forbids forbids separation of religion and state. And Sharia itself pushes for a dominance of Islam in the states that are run by dominant Islamic countries, and that the real desire is for that in America, eventually that would happen here. So how do you address that?
Well, in a partly just to look at the evidence. Again, Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, is a secular republic. Bangladesh, the third or the fourth largest Muslim country in the world, is a secular republic. Pakistan, which does call itself the Islamic Republic of Pakistan and does use Sharia law, also has large evangelical presence within the country. I'm not going to paint a rosy picture about Pakistan. Pakistan has many problems, particularly with its religious minorities, and not just religious minorities, across faiths. So with Christians and with other really Hindus, they have problems. But they also have problems within their own religious traditions. So between Shias and Sunnis and between other minority communities, there is friction and tension. There are problems. But generally speaking, there is a large Christian community in Pakistan. I know many of my friends who are in the evangelical community who want to go and proselytize or who want to go and preach their faith in other countries. Pakistan is one of their top choices they want to go to, because they feel this is a country where their message is well received. So there are examples of that. So you have to look at this issue. Now, within Sharia, here is a little bit, and I hate to bore you with facts. Sharia is to Muslims what halakha would be to Jews or canon law would be to Catholics. So when you think about halakha or canon law, can you separate your practice as a Jew or a Catholic from that body of literature? You can't. You are borrowing at some level from that body of literature, from that sacred text. Does it mean you adopt wholesale everything and not adapt and recontextualize it where you are living and the time you are living in? Of course not. The Judaism that is practiced now does not resemble the Judaism when the halakhic laws were first promulgated. The same thing with Sharia. Sharia is, at its core, first of all, there is no book called Sharia. You can't find it on anybody's shelf. Sharia is a loose understanding of Islam's sacred text. And the first source of that sacred text is the Quran, which is a book of about 114 chapters, about 6,000 verses. And it is used in spiritual services, prayer services, in any other kind of sacred services that any religious body performs. So that's the primary source of what we would consider what is part of Sharia. Then what comes are other sacred sources, which include what we call the traditions of Prophet Muhammad. What he said, what he approved, what he did, as recounted by his companions. And over there, that text is much more contested than the text of the Quran. The text of the Quran, whether somebody is a Shia or a Sunni or a Ismaili or a Ahmadi, they read from the same Quran. It's the same Arabic text that they read. In terms of the prophetic traditions, there is quite a bit of variation. What they read, what they consider authentic, how they interpret it varies from region to region. It varies across time. How people interpret a certain prophetic tradition today will be very different than how it was interpreted at the time of Prophet Muhammad. So there is that variation. And then there are other things that get part of Sharia, which can include what is the consensus of the scholarship on a certain matter. For example, many matters could not have been provided a religious decree or a religious understanding at the time of the Prophet. For example, is using cell phones legal in Islam? Of course, in 7th century Arabia, nobody could have given you a fatwa on that one. So you have to divine that now. You have to figure it out. You know, what does the religious text mean? That can also become part of the Sharia. But Sharia would be like the U.S. Constitution. If I want to break it down, it will be like the U.S. Constitution, in that it is vague, it is very broad-based, it does not tell you exactly what to do under every circumstance. Then from the Constitution, what do? You write legislation. Then from the legislation, you write rules. So there's a three-step process before you get to the grassroots of what does it mean. Sharia goes through the same process. It is like you go from the general to legislative, to rulemaking. Now, in many countries, for example, Muslim-majority countries like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, they do derive certain legislative aspects from the Sharia. But does not mean all their laws are based on the Sharia, because they use partly and they don't use it. Some of it is, again, based on cultural traditions. You know, for example, on the issue of Sharia, if you go to Pakistan, almost 80-90% of people in Pakistan would say that they would like to see Sharia as part of their laws. They're not saying they want to see Sharia as part of U.S. laws, but they want to see it as part of their laws. But if you go to Turkey, less than 10% of the people would say that they like to see Sharia as part of their laws. In Indonesia, same thing, 20-30% of the people may ask that. Which, by the way, if you poll Americans and ask Americans what percentage of Americans would like to see Bible as our laws, you would get, surprisingly, you would not get a 10-15% number, you get a number that is close to 30-40%. So that kind of tendency is not uncommon in other countries. And I want to end with this. When you look at the attitudes of some Muslim societies about Sharia, much of their contemporary attitude is actually shaped by the failure of every other system. In other words, these countries have gone through colonialism, and that did not work for them. They tried democracy, that did not work for them. They tried authoritarian regimes, that did not work for them. So they've experimented with many things, and pretty much everything has failed. So now they're saying, well, but since everything has failed, maybe this is a solution. But that's the experience of a people in a particular society at a particular time. There is no way you can generalize that to American Muslims. American Muslims, at least I have not encountered any major American Muslim group, nor any major Islamic center in this country, nor even individuals that I interact with that ever demand Sharia to be the part of this law. And by the way, let me put it in finally in these terms. I've traveled across many Muslim countries. And every time I travel overseas, I come back to my country here, I kiss the ground, figuratively. Why? Because there is no other place in the world where I can practice Islam more freely than in the United States of America.
And every time I go to New York, I get teary when I see the Statue of Liberty. Not just because it's New York. Tim has a comment question, and I'm going to ask our panel to keep things short because I do want to get I want to get to audience questions. Questions. Not sermons. Questions. Go ahead, Tim.
I think, Doctor, I think you may have already answered this in the last question. My question was also about Sharia, just understand it. Because you mentioned the canon law of Catholics, but it's very clear in canon law. I mean, this is dealing with salvation. This is dealing with, like, sin, the administration of churches and dioceses, how a parish is founded, who's the authority over it, and so on. There is a history and a tradition in the Catholic understanding of a separation of church and state. It was articulated well before the fall of the Roman Empire, of this idea that the church is in charge. Now, it didn't always get played out, let's be honest, but this is part of our tradition.
In another setting, I would actually push back with you on that, but that's okay.
That's fine. We can go round and round some other time, Jack, on that. But
maybe we'll do it on the radio.
The point is that, well, we can't point to just the failures of particular groups in particular history and overgeneralize it, which is, I think, what we're talking about. That's the same mistake that we're making. We can't say that Israel is an example of every single Jewish person and their political views, either the way they treat Palestinians. So I think we have to be fair and try to look at what is the actual doctrinal belief of Christianity or Judaism. I think maybe that's the confusion is, what is Islam? You know, I mean, what is it? I mean, there's different people have different understandings, like you're saying, interpretations. They're Sunni, they're Shia, even in Sharia. But canon law is not, we cannot make canon law the law of the United States. It doesn't have anything in there to do about governing a country. Is Sharia like that in the same way? Is it, or is it, I mean, is it something that's
much
separate from, like, government?
Much of it is.
Okay.
But there is parts of Sharia that will talk about governance. But governance is not based on a particular system of governance. There is no system of governance articulated anywhere in the Quran. There is no system of governance that is articulated in the Quran. In fact, when Prophet Muhammad died, he did not even appoint a successor who would take in charge of his community. There could not be a prophet after him, but somebody to manage the society. He did not appoint it. And many Muslim scholars have said the reason he did not appoint one, which he could have, but he chose not to do it because he left it to the Muslims of that time to figure out how they would govern themselves best. And so in Sharia, there are broad principles of governance, which not be different, and I'm sure there are in canon law broad principles of governance, as there are in halakhic law. How should a society govern itself? What are the issues of fairness, treatment of others, dealing with the rule of law? All of those things are part of Sharia. So that cannot be, and by the way, I would have pushed back on this in another setting with your characterization that there is nothing in canon law that resolves, that is dealing with governance issues, because the experience of Muslims from the times of the Crusade to the colonial rule has been very, very different. And many people would say, well, that both the Crusade as well as the colonial experience was actually a religious-based persecution. That's not a commonly understood thing, but it is also something that many Muslims will push back on. I'm just going to put it out there. Because just that there are misinformation and misunderstanding of Islam in a region where Islam is a minority The same thing holds in the other part of the world, particularly in that part of the world where Muslims have faced the brunt of colonialism and other issues. Now to the issue of, does Sharia law have something within it that, I want to answer it this way. What is in the law, ultimately, first of all, there is nothing called Sharia law. Again, as I said, there is no book called Sharia. So there is not a text sitting on my desk that says, I want to figure out how the United States government should be run. I pull out a book and it gives me a prescription on it. It doesn't. It only tells me that there is a jurisprudence of living as a religious minority. There is a jurisprudence on living as a religious majority. There are, just like it would be for any other religion. You know, Jews lived as a religious minority for much of their history. In Israel, they live as a religious majority now. The jurisprudence that they applied when they lived as a minority is very different than the jurisprudence they apply when they're living as a majority. And that would be true for every religion. It's not unique to Islam. So within that understanding of Sharia, not the law of Sharia, because there is, again, as I said, there is no law book called Sharia. There are rules that you can derive from sacred texts. So much of Sharia, in fact, 2/3 of the Quran relates to issues of worship, issues of theology, like who God is and how to understand God, how to understand the nature of God, how to relate to God. There are 114 chapters of the Quran. 113 of those chapters open with the phrase, in the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. So the dominant theme of the Quran is about grace and about mercy. That's part of Sharia. Are there some verses in the Quran that deal with capital punishment? Yes. There are probably out of well over 6,200 verses, if I remember correctly, fewer than 10 or 15 of those verses would be about capital punishment. Again, the reductionist viewpoint is those 10 represent the entirety of Sharia, as opposed to say, well, that's part of living and there is a prescription on how the principle applies. Now, how do we go from the principle to the actual rule on the ground will depend upon context. Some countries have adopted capital punishment and some countries have rejected capital punishment. For example, in Turkey, they've rejected capital punishment. In other parts of the world, they rejected capital punishment, even though they're Muslim majority. Some countries like Saudi Arabia, they do apply capital punishment.
I want to get questions from the floor. And again, let me stress that there is no question that you cannot ask. So please, 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 do not fear to ask anything. Yes, go ahead.
Everybody to not clap. It takes time, but it also sort of gets kind of a tribal thing going that we would like to avoid. So, questions.
Got one right.
Oh. Careful.
Got one right here.
Okay. I like the direction that this is going, because this is something that the Sharia law and the Islam that I've had a lot of questions about. And with the Sharia law, you say there's nothing written anywhere, but you have countries that live under Sharia law. So there has to be something written that they're living under. And then I've seen where in the United States, in Muslim pockets like the Somalis in Minnesota, Dearborn, that they're interviewed and they say, do you prefer American law or Sharia law? And they say they would prefer Sharia law. So what are they referencing compared to American law? Because the things that come up in Sharia law are pretty tough stuff, you know, like being able to marry a 9-year-old, rape, stuff like that, the stuff you see a lot on, you know, programs.
First of all, there are several questions you asked. I'll try to get to them as quickly as possible because Jack is pressing me to not give my academic answers to every question. So I'll try to make it brief. Countries have laws, and those laws are written. They're not Sharia laws. They may be derived from Sharia. So not every aspect of a country's law, every country will have a written law book from which they will rule. Not every, everybody has a law, but not the entirety of the law is borrowed from Sharia. They could be borrowed from their culture, borrowed from their particular history. They could have innovated into something else. So every country is different. So again, they get the main point I'm trying to, if there's one take-home message that I want you to go away with, is do not have a reductionist view of Islam. Taking the worst elements and the worst practices of a society and generalizing that to 1.6 billion people. It would not be fair if I did that for any other society, any other community. Certainly, in Quebec, just a few days ago, a person walked in, an anti-immigrant, white nationalist, supremacist person, walked into a mosque and murdered six worshippers while they were praying. Should we take that person as representative of the entire Western civilization? Just a few months ago, a person walked into a church in Charleston, South Carolina, not too far from here, and killed worshippers. Is that person representative of Christianity? So there are always examples like this, and we need to avoid that. So in every country, you will find exceptions to the rules, things that will bend the rules. Now, that was one part of it. The second part, you asked about Dearborn and asked about pockets of Somali populations. I would like to see videos or evidence where a person said they would prefer Sharia law over the United States Constitution. I've not seen that. I've seen propaganda about it, but I've not seen actual evidence about it. To the contrary, all you need to do, I'll cite you the source, you can look this up. Go to Pew's website and look at reports under U.S. religious groups. Among many Christians, 20, 30, 40% in some cases, you will find people who would say they would like to see Bible being the law of this country, replacing the U.S. Constitution. So many people live that, they express that point of view. But we are not alarmed by their point of view. But if a kid in Minnesota...
Let me tell you that I'm alarmed by their point of view. And I will also... No clapping. And I will also add that from a Jewish perspective, there are laws in this country clearly derived from Christian belief that the Jews in the room, if I started to talk about them, we would all be scratching our heads and say, really? Really? We really have to do that? Okay? So you can point across the religious spectrum. Yes, Liz.
Okay, we're definitely going to have to go pick up the speed here.
Okay.
Or run a little longer.
I guess a question for our inspiring and hopeful main speaker. Would it be fair to ask, is religious fundamentalism in all its colors and denominations, is this itself compatible with Western democracy?
I'll let others answer that question also, but I'll just say it in this manner. I'm a person of faith, and yet I do uphold the separation of church and state in its strongest terms. And I do it. Some of my reasons are altruistic, but actually most of my reasons are very parochial. And the reason is, and I want people of faith to think about this. If you blur the lines between church and state, and as a person of faith, if you think you are going to influence the state, you are sadly mistaken. It will be the state that will corrupt your religion. And that is the lived history of Muslims. If you look at Muslim civilizations, if you study them carefully, most Islamic scholars avoided becoming part of the state apparatus. Even when they were threatened that if they do not become part of the state apparatus, they would be jailed or killed. And the reason they avoided it is precisely because of that. First of all, they acknowledged that there is no one interpretation of Islam. There are varied interpretations of Islam. And they wanted to preserve that pluralistic ethos within Islam. And the second, they always feared that if they become part of the state will coerce them to corrupt their religious practices.
So I wonder if the rest of the panel has comments on that particular question.
I was actually going to ask them to comment.
I think it depends on the religion, candidly. So I'll give an example, even from Christianity, because I know we'll address that one since that one's taken a few pot shots without being able to fire back. when it comes to Christian faith, I will tell you, as I understand Christianity, we believe in what we would call soul competency, which is this idea that each soul stands competent before the Creator to be accountable for how they believe and how they act and how they respond, that they're not under compulsion from a church or a government or anything like that. And so in order to live out that soul competency, even if you were to believe with conviction that certain things should be illegal and certain things should be compulsory, that recognition would require a certain level of religious pluralism in a society in order for people, like you said, to not be compelled to adhere to the state's understanding of religion. So even if the sense of justice and fairness and what was right and wrong in a culture was shaped by a particular worldview or religious system, in order to adhere to this sense of soul competency, this autonomy to follow and live as one believes, what we would call religious freedom, that requires that you have the ability to dissent, which even in our country right now, you know, there are certain views that the government holds that's antithetical to traditional Christian belief. And the struggle is for the Christian to have the freedom to dissent from that view or for the Christian to be compelled to adhere to that view.
Tim, did you want to add anything? And Betsy?
I think when we say fundamentalist, I think, again, that's a broad stroke. A fundamentalist from Westboro Baptist Church would be very different than what you may identify. And people in here probably have different understandings of what a fundamentalist is. So I do think it can be, to answer your question, could it be a problem with democracy? But I think at the very core of this issue and why we're here today is that our values in this country didn't just get whipped out of thin air. They have a history, and they're based on a philosophical understanding of what a right is and what people's value and their dignity is. And in our tradition, it came from John Locke, it came from Jefferson, that they derived their authority, or rights to derive their authority, from the Creator, from God. This is just the reality that we live in right now. And we can question that or pull the rug out from underneath it, but that's just the tradition that we've inherited, which has been bequeathed to us. Fundamentalists, I think ultimately, look, all of us have values. All of us, and our values are informed by our beliefs. And the only way forward as a community and as a nation, which is very mixed in its way of thinking and its religion and its culture and its ethnicity, is that we must respect one another. And no law or any authority can command me to do what is right or what is wrong. That's what Martin Luther King said. So the law doesn't make right all the time. So we have to, as a group, there's this tension that's always going to exist between how do we make law in this country and still respect one another's beliefs. And but we have to have respect, and it starts with dignity and respect for each single human being, no matter where they come from, no matter what their faith is, no matter who their parents were, no matter what their skin color is. It starts with that.
Liz,
I know you would applaud if you could, but that's okay.
Liz, you have somebody in the back with a question.
I have two questions. One is a question for the crowd, if you would indulge me, and then a question for the panel. The question for the crowd is, how many in this room, if you don't mind raising your hands, consider yourself liberals? Liberals. How many consider yourself liberals? So, okay, the question for the panel is, have you thought about taking the show on the road to where there's a more mixture between the conservatives and the liberals in the room? Say if we move out to different rural areas of Florida.
Well, I'll speak for Parvez and myself. We are always, the two of us have been doing this kind of thing for a while. And our goal is to push this further. If you know any place that wants to invite, I can't demand that the others join us, but if you know any place that wants to invite Parvez and myself, we'll take that invitation.
Absolutely.
Now, do I get the others? Do I get the rest of you with me? Okay. All right.
Depends on where you go.
So, Josh, I won't take you to New York City. So let me ask a question of everybody. Are you okay if we run a little bit long? Okay, because I think that we're making good ground. We got to push further. Go ahead, Liz.
Got one here, too.
I really like the issue of what's representative of Islam, so that was really the core of my question. You mentioned people will say, oh, it's the religion's fault, but I wouldn't say that's out of nowhere. I think the claim for a oppressive regime is they say it's their religion. They say it's their interpretation of Sharia. They say it's their religious edicts from whatever they're sourcing. So when you say you're reducing too much people, you shouldn't be using that as representative, how would you go about finding the representative method of Islam? I know you use a lot of numbers, but I think the argument is the Middle East is kind of the birthplace for Islam. There's like an authenticity there. I was wondering how you squared away the authenticity of the region versus appealing to the globalist numbers where you're pointing out other countries that sure have a lot of people, but how do you square that with the source of the religion itself?
The Middle East is the birthplace of Christianity and Judaism also. It's not just Islam. So somehow we have made Islam a Middle Eastern religion, and we think of Christianity and Judaism as Western religions. They're all Middle Eastern religions. And to your question about who... So the central question that if I may reframe the question, if you're okay with that, is who speaks for Islam? So the answer is no one. There is no singular authority in Islam that can speak for the entire religion. Islam is not like Catholic Church. It is much more closer to Judaism and Protestantism than it is to Catholicism. There is no singular authority. There is even in its similarity with Judaism and Protestantism, there's a significant difference. For example, in Judaism, you have Reformed Jews under certain guidelines and certain schooling systems and certain educational perspectives that will have a level of coherence within their understanding of Reformed Judaism, and similarly for others. In Islam, there is no such thing as a Reform Islam and a Conservative Islam and a Baptist Islam or a Methodist Islam. There is no such thing. Because Islam does not have hierarchical religious authority. We often think that the counterpart of a rabbi or a priest or a reverend in Islam is the imam. And the answer is yes and no. In some sense, the imam is somewhat like a rabbi because they have powers to lead, they have vested authority to lead in certain religious services. But they're not like priests or rabbis in which they have the kind of religious authority that a rabbi or a priest, certainly a Catholic priest, commands.
So is that part of the challenge that exists, that we hear some people say that Muslims are not speaking out enough against terrorism? Is that part of sort of the dynamic there?
Well,
you don't have a pope say things?
Yeah. On that question, I think people are not listening. Because if you simply Google Muslims condemn terrorism, you can pull out your phones and Google that right now and see what comes up. It's not a couple of pages, hundreds, thousands of pages of condemnations. I'm going to quiz you on something. Do you think Muslims condemned Osama bin Laden? Yes or no? Do you think Muslims condemned Osama bin Laden? Yes. When? Can you give me a time period when they condemned him? After 9/11? Before 9/11. The earliest fatwa against Osama bin Laden was in 1999, long before people in the West even heard the name Osama bin Laden. And the reason is very simple. The victims of Muslim extremism are Muslims. The biggest victims, if you look at the number of people, just do a tally, number of people killed by ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and see what faith they represent. The majority of those victims are Muslims. So, of course, Muslims have a vested interest in condemning this extremist group. They have ravaged societies. And not to mention, every time somebody blows up someplace, I have to appear on television to answer for 1.6 billion people. I don't want to do that. I'm not representative of Islam. I'm only speaking for myself. I cannot represent Islam. So there is no authority. And yet, there are what are... I mean, so the religion does not function in complete anarchy either. So there is an order. In some sense, Islam is the most democratic religion. It does not vest authority into hierarchy and singular people. But there is an orderliness within that process. And that is very particular to very different societies. For example, in the US, every Islamic center has its own independent board of trustees made up of people who live in that community. They don't get directions from Saudi Arabia. They don't get directions from whatever place, New York or any place else. It is their community. They come together. They figure out how best we should govern our Islamic centers. They come up with rules and bylaws, and they have messy elections where over which everybody fights. Nobody can agree on anything. If you think Jewish people argue a lot, you need to come to the Islamic Center board meetings.
There I'm going to argue with you more. Two Jews don't agree on anything.
Yeah. Two Muslims never agree on anything either.
Can I just, I don't know, maybe I'm the only one in this room that's waiting for you to help us understand ISIS. Help us to understand how young American Muslims are radicalized. Help us to understand why there is so much terrorism in the name of Allah. We don't know how to put our heads around it. I understand you're saying Islam's a religion of peace and people practice it differently, but when we open the newspaper or see the TV, we need you to help us to understand.
Well, I never said Islam is a religion of peace, and I would never say that, because Islam is neither a religion of peace nor a religion of war. It is what people who practice it make of it, and that's probably true for every other religion. It is not what is ultimately what's written in the text. Most people outside the religion don't care. Most people inside the religion never read. I'm sure a rabbi will complain about that too. So ultimately, it is how people live it. So is there a problem with people committing violence in the name of Islam? And the answer is obviously yes. Are the numbers distressingly high? And the answer is also yes. But that, for me to answer that question in any comprehensive way, and I'm going to force myself another invitation to come here and give you almost an hour-long presentation on it. I have written on this subject, I have published on this subject in reputable journals of law. So it's a longer discourse, and it's a very complex, nuanced answer. I know the tendency is to look for an easy answer, what explains this? But there is no easy answer to that question. The facts are facts, that there are people within Islam, people who are practicing the faith of Islam, who are committing violence in the name of that faith. But the question remains, why are they committing it? And how do you solve that problem? You cannot solve the problem without understanding why this is happening. The first question that comes, that in my thesis as I answer the question, is there anything within sacred texts that motivates this violence? And the answer is yes and no. There is no, if it was only about religion, this problem would have been much more widespread than we see today. There are 1.6 billion Muslims live as minorities in almost every country in the world, and they live as majorities in 47 out of the 50-odd countries in the world. So it's a large population across a vast geography. And when you look at incidences of violence and terrorism in the name of Islam, first thing you notice, they are very localized in certain areas. Much of that violence is coming from regions like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia. Why? They're failed states, essentially. The governing apparatus have failed. And there have been a variety of factors that have pushed people to violence. I'm not justifying their actions. There is nothing that justifies terrorism. There is nothing that justifies the killing of innocent people. So there are factors. So unless you address those factors that have created a sense of hopelessness and helplessness in societies, where it motivates people to pick up or strap a bomb to redress their grievances, there is nothing we cannot bomb our way out of this problem. We have been bombing Iraq for the last 10 years. The problem has only gotten worse. It should tell us something. We have spent, since we declared the war on terror, we have spent conservatively over $3 trillion, with a T, on the so-called war on terror. And are we close to solving it? Nowhere close to solving it. Why? Because much, and I did this math in my paper, I showed this in my presentation, almost 95% of that money has been spent on war efforts. Very little on diplomacy, very little on social expenditures like education and create. There are no easy answers to these problems. And the problem is not all us. But we are a major player in the problem, but it is not all our fault. Us as a country. A lot of the people in the region do bear the majority share of the blame. Why did 15 of the 19 hijackers come from Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia bears that blame. Not 1.6 billion Muslims, not the Muslim who's living in Indonesia, not the Muslim living in India. What has he or she got to do with the 15 hijackers coming from Saudi Arabia? Nothing.
Okay, we're going to take one more question and then wrap. Okay.
Okay, so when you said that, of course, you said it would be history, more or less, what had caused the situation that we have right now. So what can we do now before not only waiting for you to come back, but how we as a person, each person on our own, do to have a better understanding of the situation? Where can we go? I mean, are we ignorant? Is that, I mean...
So before you answer, Parvez, I'm going to actually ask you to answer, and then I'm going to ask everybody on the panel to give their thoughts on how we can all better understand, and then we'll wrap things up. Go ahead.
Well, understanding is a two-way street. Just as we would have to understand Muslim societies better, Islam as a religion better, so do people who are Muslims and living in Muslim-majority countries. They would have to understand our culture, our foreign policy, our perspectives better. No one side can solve the problem. And if we are constantly attacking each other, if we are building walls and banning people from coming to the country, the problem just got harder. It was a hard problem to solve to begin with. The problem just got many, many fold harder. Because we have now cut off ourselves from the very people who would be necessary to build bridges of understanding. For example, the people who are affected by the travel ban, the Muslim ban from the executive order, are people like Iranian scientists. The very people who can go back and help build a civil society, help build bridges of understanding. And so when, like this morning, Iran said they're not going to allow American wrestlers to come in for a wrestling competition into Iran, a world wrestling competition in Iran. Again, the same problem from the other side. You cut off the very people, American wrestlers going to Iran, spending some time in Iran, coming back, will be the best ambassadors for that culture and that country. So we have to take time to understand and read about other people and culture. You know, before 9/11, there were very few good books about Islam and Muslim societies. I can't say that that's true anymore now. In the last 10 to 12 years, tremendous amount of academic and easy to understand, not just, you know, ivory tower academic literature, but good books have been produced on the subject of Islam and understanding Muslim societies. I'm sure public library over here, because many public libraries participated in that, there was a bookshelf program that was put together by the American Library Association. They put together a list of about 25 or 30 books. You can go to your public library and inquire about that. I forgot what the title was, but there was a bookshelf that they had put together recommending books to read to better understand Muslim societies. You could start there. And then let's have more conversation.
I'm going to let Josh and Tim and Betsy also respond to that question.
Okay. Go ahead. Not to be simplistic, but I would say it's conversation. It's finding somebody, and I think it's the same way that we address, in a pluralistic society, it's the same way we address religious differences, racial differences, economic differences. You've got to step out of your echo chamber, and the gentleman who asked for the show of hands in here revealed that there's a bit of an echo chamber in here. You've got to step out of that echo chamber, and you've got to find somebody who looks different than you, that believes different than you, that thinks differently than you do, and genuinely try to hear from them and get to know them, even though that doesn't mean that you're suddenly going to get persuaded with the virtue of their perspective, but hopefully you can see them as an individual. And I think the other thing that helps to do is break down this this concern about this reductionistic view that Parvez was talking about, where we just see somebody, you know, we'll those that we don't like, it's easy to put them all in a big pile and see uniformity. Those that look like us, we allow for nuance. Well, I'm not like that version of my belief system. I'm different, but we want to do that. And so I think just getting to know somebody, the discouraging part of that is it's so granular, it's so drop in a bucket, you really can feel like, how is that making a bit of difference? But you two are testimony to that, and we're here today because of what you two are doing. So
I agree. I would say I echo the same thing. I would say, this dialogue, I've learned a lot. I've unfortunately in my life, I don't think I've ever had many encounters with Muslims. So I haven't been able to ask these questions. So some of the questions I've asked you, I've asked my friends over beer and stuff, you know, we're having our discussions. I said, why is this? But they don't have the answer, but they're not Muslims. So they don't have a good, you know, they don't know either. So I'm glad, I was very thankful to have the opportunity to ask these questions.
It was the beer.
Yeah, maybe the beer.
And you could not ask Parvez that question over beer.
Yeah. Oh, man, rough. So
if we can change the drink, we can have another conversation.
Okay. But no, I mean, I think that's, again, being able to encounter you, to see you. And always, my friends, when we have ideas of people, they become caricatures. But when you look at another human being in the eyes, it's something different. And I think it opens the door to seeing, you know, one another as humans again. So I think that's it. I mean, just to seek out. I mean, it's encouraged me to maybe seek out. I know my parish, my former parish, had interacted with the mosque here in town. But it's encouraged me to learn more and to dig in more about. This is obviously a big issue in our current culture right now.
On Tuesday, we're having a cooking class at Good Samaritan hosted by the Istanbul Cultural Center, Turkish Muslims. And they do this as a goodwill gesture to the community. I don't know if there's any slots left, but that's an example. They're coming to teach us one of the recipes, and then we'll have lunch together. The other thing that our preschool has done, these are just real practical, is we teach the kids about different holidays. So we had Diwali, and we had Ramadan, and we teach them. So just learning about other people's holidays and recognizing those are like really small little steps towards understanding that can be done anytime, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be a big thing. It can be a small thing.
Okay, Tim has a quick announcement, and then
just,
I got to wrap up.
Yeah, someone reminded me. It's St. Thomas More on Tuesday, or I'm sorry, on Sunday at 2 o'clock. They're having a prayer vigil for refugees and migrants throughout the world, so you are welcome to come to that. I won't be there just because I already had a commitment to the American Legion chaplains thing. Do you do that still, Jack?
No.
No.
Yeah. All right. So one of the points that was made earlier was in response to a question, and Parvez made it, and I'm going to reiterate it to close. In my closing remarks, and that is Islam, Judaism do not have singular authorities. In fact, every rabbi is empowered to make decisions and speak for their community. And by the way, one of the ways America has changed Judaism is that rabbis aren't prayer leaders in traditional Judaism. Rabbis are community leaders and teachers. But in America, we become prayer leaders. Okay, so rabbis and imams and many pastors are empowered for their community only, to speak for their community only. And what has happened is certain ones who are saying things and doing things that everybody in this room would say is abhorrent are getting the highest platform. Their words are getting out the most. It's important that we never judge an entire group of people by the loudest voice. And by the way, that's not just about Muslims. It's not just about Jews or Christians or religious groups. It's about everyone. Liberals and conservatives. Never judge based on a certain voice. When 20 years ago, when I was living in the bubble of Philadelphia, up north, I never in my mind ever dreamed that I could have good relationships and friends with Southern Baptists. They seemed like the most anti-Jewish people in the world. And then I came to Tallahassee, and I have some of the closest relationships with people from First Baptist Church. Who'd ever have thought that? We need to break our bubbles. We need to reach out to each other, and we need to connect. That's the only way forward. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate your coming.
Now, clap.